Welcome to the Ready to Run podcast. I'm your co-host, Efren Kabalius, and I'm a sports medicine physician.
I'm your co-host, Kurt Roser, and I'm a physical therapist. We're based out of the Boulder, Colorado area and have a passion for working with endurance athletes of all abilities. The goal of our podcast is to engage in thoughtful discussions with athletes, coaches, and clinicians to share knowledge within the field of sports medicine and inspire progression in the sport of running.
We hope to empower individuals to navigate injuries, reduce injury risk, optimize training and performance, and provide listeners with the tools needed to get ready to run.
You'll be able to listen to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you enjoy listening to podcasts. Subscribe and leave a rating and review to let us know what you think and what you'd like to hear on the show.
You can also follow us on Instagram at Ready to Run Podcast, as well as our website, readytorunpodcast.com. On this week's episode of the Ready to Run podcast, we have the pleasure of meeting with Lindsay Plass to discuss femoral acetabular impingement, otherwise known as FAI, and hip labrum tears in runners. Lindsay is a Chicago-based physical therapist, performance coach, author, and international speaker. Lindsay is a former college soccer player turned 10-time marathoner and triathlete. She completed an orthopedic physical therapy residency and manual therapy fellowship, making her a board-certified orthopedic clinical specialist and fellow of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Therapists. It was her own lived experience nearly 10 years ago with hip pain related to FAI and a labrum tear that sparked her interest in helping others with hip issues getting back to doing the things they love. She's a clinician and coach and owner of Plass Physical Therapy and Performance. She's currently faculty in the University of Chicago Medicine, Orthopedic Physical Therapy Residency, and University of Chicago Manual Physical Therapy Fellowship. In 2021, Lindsay was invited to be a part of the International Young Athletes Hip Research Collaboration led by Heinrich Dijkstra, who is the Director of Medical Education at ASPTAR. Lindsay was also invited as an expert clinician panelist member at the 2022 Oxford University Young Adult Hip Consensus Meeting, where she represented physical therapists internationally. We're excited to share her wealth of knowledge and expertise in how to recognize and manage these injuries with the best current evidence. So let's get ready to run with Lindsay Plass. Welcome to the Ready to Run podcast. Today, we're very fortunate to have an expert on hip labrum pathology, Dr. Lindsay Plass, who is a physical therapist based out of Chicago. And we're going to go through some of the common terminology around femoral acetabular impingement and hip labrum tears, and talk about how to recognize these injuries, maybe how to manage them, and then some of the things you really want to educate yourself on to consider when you're figuring out what's the best way to manage this for you, if you are someone who is dealing with this injury or someone who is helping athletes who are dealing with this injury and trying to get back to the sport. So welcome to the Ready to Run podcast. Let's start by telling the listeners who you are and what gets you ready to run.
Hey, thanks for having me. So my name is Lindsay Plass. I'm a physical therapist. Also, I love to run, and I also enjoy doing triathlons. I started off when I was younger playing soccer, basketball, volleyball, eventually played soccer in college, but always really enjoyed running. It was actually my older sister who kind of, you know, when I was younger, like around like 12, 13, she would bring me out on her runs with her. And I think just watching her passion for running, I developed a great passion for running. And yeah, from there, I like eventually after college kind of started chasing marathon goals and like the goal to qualify for Boston. But over time, it's just kind of evolved where like I just really love being able to run, kind of appreciating the gift of movement, and kind of the peace that it brings me.
Great. That's awesome. Well, yeah. So why don't we start this conversation by just laying out some definitions and clearing up some of the terminology, because I know this can be kind of confusing for patients sometimes. But let's just kind of start by telling the listeners, like, what is femoral acetabular impingement and some of the associated pathologies that we see with it?
So femoral acetabular impingement, also known as FAI, is kind of a condition that can develop in the hips, and there are different types. So one type is called CAM morphology, which is where you can get a bony bump on the femoral head or the top of the thigh bone. And then another type is called pincer morphology. So this is where you can get a bony bump or extra bone on the socket side or the acetabulum. And then the third type, which is common, is called mixed morphology, which is when people have both CAM morphology and pincer morphology. And I think it's also helpful to mention we can differentiate between people who have FAI and then people who have FAI and have pain related to it by using the terminology FAI syndrome. So that's something that's kind of evolved over the past couple of years in order to better identify like who has FAI and has pain related to it.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I like that you're using the term morphology, because I think when I was in training, we would call it impingement or deformity. And I think kind of imply like a negative connotation, something that cannot be changed, or something is like people can't unsee that information.
Yeah, for sure. And I think so last year, I was part of this meeting in Oxford, England, where it was called the Oxford Consensus on Primary CAM Morphology, and it was hip experts, sports medicine physicians, surgeons, physical therapists, researchers, all coming together to better identify consistent terminology. And, you know, those guidelines were actually published last year, but they really emphasize kind of using that consistent terminology of CAM and pincer morphology. You're right, instead of deformity or lesion, because since so many people have these findings and don't have pain related to it, sometimes hearing that word deformity or lesion can cause kind of fear about their hip, or what we call like a nocebo effect, where you actually start then thinking negatively about your hip.
Yeah, definitely. So what would you say is like the prevalence of FAI type imaging findings in both, say, athletes and non-athletes, and as you mentioned, symptomatic and non-symptomatic patients?
So now I think it's pretty like well understood that the prevalence of FAI in people, it's more common in athletes versus non-athletes. And then within athletes, kind of a range of estimating that around like 50 to 70% of athletes have CAM morphology. And then I think kind of that same percentage, around 50 to 70% of athletes, if you did imaging on their hip, would also show they have a labral tear. And so I think that's a big reason why it's important we identify whether or not the labral tear and the FAI are actually contributing to someone's pain, because it is so common in people who don't actually have symptoms or pain.
Yeah. So would you say that these particular injuries have a higher association with any particular type of sport? Our podcast here is geared a lot towards runners and triathletes. And just wondering if like that particular sport is something that puts patients at a higher risk, or if it's maybe a sport that may have like performed in their youth, or maybe the intensity of the sport per se.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Now we know that the primary CAM morphology is developing during puberty, when the growth plate is open. So yeah, so a lot of what kids are doing from age 10 to kind of 17, 18 impacts the hip development. And even though they may not have symptoms until later on, like in their 20s, the FAI is actually developing when they're much younger. So I think currently it's kind of known that sports that place high loading on the hip, specifically rotational positions of deep flexion and internal rotation, kids who do those sports have a higher chance of developing FAI. So like hockey, basketball, lacrosse, soccer, and then also people who are generally more hypermobile, who participate in sports like dancing, gymnastics, could also be at risk Now, the interesting thing too is not just the sport type, but also like the dosage. So, you know, is research looking into like how often a child plays a sport? So I think that's still kind of like an up and coming area where we need more research about like how does frequency of sport impact the development of FAI? And I think a question we still don't know the answer to is, can we prevent it?
Yeah. So when would you say we should like worry about these like a CAM or pincer morphology?
Yeah, I think that's a really tough question because I think it varies so much, you know, from individual to individual. And I think, you know, that's one thing I would want kind of people listening to understand is that like FAI is so common, labral tears are common, but no two cases are the same because there's so many nuances that go into treating someone with hip pain related to FAI and labral tears. I think when we need to worry about it is when someone is having pain that's limiting function or limiting sport, to where they're not able to participate in the way they want to. Yeah,
for sure. So I guess like taking a step back here, what would you say is the function of the labrum of the hip? And then what are some of the signs and symptoms that we should maybe recognize? And also what are like the red flag signs and symptoms?
The role of the labrum is it helps cushion the hip, promotes stability, and then it promotes this seal in the hip joint where it helps keeps the femoral head or the top of the thigh bone nicely centered in the socket of the joint. And the signs and symptoms of FAI would be pain with any position of deep hip flexion, so pain with squatting. And then people will also make, we call it the C sign, where they kind of with their fingers like grab the front and the side of the hip, pointing to where they feel the pain. Pain with prolonged sitting is very common. And then some red flags, though, I think it's important to recognize is, so anytime an athlete comes in with groin pain, we have to make sure we're ruling out a bone stress injury. It's not uncommon that actually people can come in and they can have hip and groin pain, and then you do imaging and they have FAI and a labral tear, but they also have a stress fracture. So I think it's important, you know, in that scenario, treating the bone stress injury is the first priority.
Yeah. Oh, that's a really interesting one right there. Because I think I've encountered this case frequently where there's a concomitant bone stress injury in the FAI. And I guess the hard part with that one, and maybe you can comment on this, is like knowing when the pain is due to the bone injury versus the pain in the labrum. Like how do you differentiate that, or how would you approach that kind of case?
Right. So I think there's this saying that I learned from one of my mentors, that is kind of like you diagnose from the inside out, but then treat from the outside in. Now, keeping in mind with a bone stress injury, so what that means is like when you're diagnosing kind of the hip pain, you want to make sure you identify the red flag, which would be the bone stress injury. But then, so obviously for that, you know, really requires resting and then progressive loading, getting back into sport. And then you start addressing like the extra articular problems with the muscles and tendons. So I think it's important that if people have a bone stress injury, also have FAI and a labral tear, you have to take time off and really give the bone stress injury time to heal. So I think, you know, really knowing what we know about bone healing, that could be 6 months or greater. But yeah, I think it's really important people don't rush into assuming the pain is coming from the labrum or the FAI and kind of jump to surgical measures to treat that, because that may have just been an incidental finding on imaging.
Yeah, I think I actually actively have a case like that right now in a competitive collegiate runner. And we just kind of agreed to just take about 8 to 12 weeks off, depending on how he's progressing, and then kind of reassessing from there. And I always kind of debate whether or not it's like valuable to get a repeat MRI on these particular patients to see if there's like progression of healing in the bone stress injury before starting to then address the labrum, if it is in fact an issue for that patient who's like specifically who's like complaining of like ongoing groin pain, and you're not quite sure, is it still bone or is it labrum, like, you know, 3-4 months out.
Yeah, I think it can be helpful. I mean, I also had a case recently where also a collegiate runner who had pain last summer, this was before I had met her, had imaging and it showed femoral neck stress fracture. And then she had taken time off and then got back into running, trying to do winter track, and then was still having pain. It began getting worse. And then she came to see me for initial evaluation. And I like was still thinking like, this doesn't sound like just like a labral tear. So had her get repeat imaging, and sure enough, it showed like the stress fracture. So it's hard to know, like, was it just not healed from the initial bone stress injury, or did it heal? And then she had another stress fracture. It's tough to know, but I think that it can be helpful in those scenarios to get repeat imaging to kind of truly make sure it's healed before they go back to running.
Yeah, those are just those really tough cases. I wanted to see if you can maybe comment on like the distribution of pain, because I know we commonly think of it as like groin pain, but I've seen all sorts of presentations. I've had some athletes present with like posterior hip pain, lateral hip pain. Recently, almost a year ago, a pro triathlete really didn't complain of any pain in the groin. Had some lateral hip pain. Her main complaint was like pain along like the front and inner part of the thigh. Yeah, maybe comment on distribution of pain.
Yeah, so I think in general, like pain related to the labral tear, it's common to see kind of in the groin, like the crease of, you know, someone's hip joint, or they'll point like just directly to like their inner thigh in the groin. And then pain related more like to the CAM morphology is typically going to be higher up on the more like lateral part of the hip, by a bone that we call your ASIS. And then people with pincer morphology, that may actually be more likely to present kind of in the back of the hip. So like deep buttock pain. But you're right, there's so much overlap. So it can, like a lot of these things can be, you know, groin pain could also be an inguinal hernia. It could be adductor tendinopathy. It could be pelvic floor. The lateral hip pain could be like the gluteal tendons, you know, greater trochanter bursa. And then the pincer morphology can also kind of present as like, you know, hamstring tendinopathy. So it's tough. It's really like, that's why I kind of say you have to like approach it in layers, kind of peeling back one layer at a time to try to kind of put the pieces together of what's really going on.
Yeah, definitely have to like really dissect these. So what are like the key components of like your physical exam and diagnostic workup to help differentiate from those other pathologies that you mentioned, or even from like a lumbar spine etiology?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Mike Raymond is a physical therapist out in Duke, and he's done such incredible things for, you know, the field of FAI and studying hip pain. He did his PhD on FAI. And whenever you hear him talk, he has this great quote that says, like, for these patients, you know, 75% of the information needed to kind of diagnose them, you're getting actually from the subjective interview, which is when we're talking with the patient, asking them their story. So I think that's really important. You know, like you have to get a good history. You have to identify like, how long have you had the pain? You know, is it acute, or is it chronic? You know, do you have a history of back pain, history of knee pain, kind of what was your sporting history? Like all these things. So I think kind of keeping that in mind. And then for the physical exam, like we were saying, I think kind of my first goal is like rule out like a bone stress injury. So typically, you know, with that, I'm looking at right away, like, can they just stand on the leg, you know, single leg stance? Okay, they can do that. Then I'm looking, okay, can they hop on that leg? Repeatedly hopping, single leg hopping. And then the other thing I like to do is then get the person lying down. And then you're looking at, can they do a leg raise? So actively lifting up their leg and then actively lifting up their leg, making a circle. And if during those tests, like those tests provoke their pain, like their kind of sharp groin pain, then I'm thinking we need to rule out bone stress injury before kind of further testing. Just because again, like you don't, the risk of like doing more harm than good. So let's say that all of that is good, that doesn't provoke their pain. Then you're right, I'm looking at clearing the lumbar spine. So do they have any pain with lumbar range of motion? You're also looking at the knee. So we want to make sure we look at joints above and below. And then as far as the exam for the hip, so really kind of the best test we have, you know, to identify if it is FAI labral tear is a test called the flexion adduction internal rotation test, which is where the person is lying on their back and we maneuver their hip and knee into deep flexion. And then we internally rotate the hip. But even with that test, you know, it's good at like, if they don't have pain, okay, it kind of rules out the labrum, but if they do have pain with that test, we still can't be confident that it is the labrum causing their pain. So, and maybe I guess it's a good time kind of mention that because the gold standard actually for identifying a labral tear is actually like in a hip surgery where they're looking at it. And then next best is kind of the MR with the dye. So injecting the dye, but yeah, I think it's tough to diagnose.
Yeah. Usually when these patients are coming into my clinic, like your physical exam is very, tells you a lot of information as to the history, but then I'm often getting MRIs in these patients mainly to rule certain things out. And also kind of letting the patient know, hey, look, we might find a labrum tear here and it may not even be the source of your symptoms.
Right. I just want to jump in and say, that's like so incredible that you do that. And I wish, you know, like I wish a lot of clinicians were doing that, where you kind of set the, like you set the stage, like, hey, it could show a labral tear, but we're not sure, you know, because like back in 2014, when I was going through my own kind of hip experience where like getting diagnosed with a labral tear and FAI, like I didn't have that. And so when I, you know, when I saw my imaging report, even though I was a PT, I was a newer grad only practicing for 2 years, but still like seeing those words really, you know, right away, I started kind of thinking the worst and like, oh my gosh, I have this labral tear. Like, does this mean I have to stop running? So I think just like that phrase that you say to people is really great because it kind of can put people at ease. Like, hey, you may have this, but it may be nothing. It may be related to your pain.
Yeah, totally. I mean, just one of those things. This is the sensitivity of the test. I think Philippon put out a study in 2011, which quoted something like 70% of patients will have some sort of labrum tear on the MRI in a, you know, young, healthy, active patient. And something like what, 30-40% of them may actually be truly symptomatic. So it's just a high false positive rate. And I guess with that being said, when you do see a labrum tear and you're trying to determine, is it the true pain generator? How valuable is like, say, like a diagnostic injection in your kind of approach to these patients?
Yeah, I think it's really valuable. And I think if anybody is even considering surgery, like it's essential that they get one before pursuing surgery. I think because, so the role of the diagnostic injection is, you know, they're injecting short acting pain reliever into the joint, inside the joint. So the theory is that if it alleviates their pain, you know, it's usually just going to be like a couple hours or so, but if it, you know, kind of completely alleviates their pain, then you can be more confident that the pain is coming from inside the joint. And it's also helpful to mention, like, it's a, the diagnostic injection has also been found to be a predictor of outcome for hip arthroscopy surgery. So people who had the injection and had significant pain relief are more likely to have a good outcome with a hip arthroscopy, whereas people who have the injection don't have significant pain relief, who go on to get a hip arthroscopy, are more likely to have a poor outcome.
Yeah, probably because it wasn't causing the pain in the first place.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I know when I do my diagnostic injections, I'll do like a pre-physical exam. We're just doing those impingement maneuvers that you described. And typically I'll just do like an anesthetic. I know that there are some where they'll use like a corticosteroid, but I hesitate to do that in a patient who has essentially fairly healthy hip, especially if there's no osteoarthritis on that MRI.
Yeah.
So I don't know if what your experience has been with that, but I know, you know, personally, I don't like doing corticosteroid on those injections.
Yeah. And I think that's another really good point. And it's great that that's your mindset. So I think patients should know to ask about that. Like, if they're offered a cortisone injection, kind of asking like, well, why is it recommended? Because I think now we know that, you know, yeah, more than one cortisone injection into a joint can start to lead to kind of harmful effects on the cartilage. So I think, yeah, just kind of patients or people should advocate and ask. And I think, yeah, maybe if you have any advice for patients, I guess, you know, that's great that like they're really lucky then if they get to work with you. Because I think not all people kind of approach it that way, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think a lot of it's kind of common that people will be offered like the diagnostic injection and the cortisone at the same time. And so maybe they don't know, like they don't actually really need the cortisone.
Yeah. I think it's based on the literature you described where like more than one corticosteroid injection leading to some degradation of the cartilage. And, you know, you may need that corticosteroid at some point. And so I don't want to like burn it.
Right. For that instance. Yeah.
But, yeah. So that being said, so now once you've actually diagnosed, okay, we figured out, hey, this is the true pain generator for you. You have FAI, labrum tear, and for conversational purpose, let's stick to like the small, this is a common finding anymore, small, you know, non-detached labrum tear with either a CAM or a pincer morphology and no osteoarthritis. So essentially a stable labrum tear.
Okay.
So what kind of like functional impairments would you see in these kinds of patients? And then, how would you approach that in terms of your management?
Yeah. So going back to kind of that idea of like, okay, we treat from the outside in, what that means is, you know, we're looking at the strength of all the hip muscles, even the back muscles. And then, you know, particularly in the hip, you have this group of muscles called the deep rotator muscles, which help control rotation. And that's something I almost always find is kind of weak or impaired on, you know, these patients with hip pain, and something I find that makes a significant difference in changing their pain. So, you know, a lot of times that people will say, I've tried physical therapy, I've tried exercise for 6 to 8 weeks, and I'm not getting better. And then I kind of ask them what they've been doing. And a lot of it is more working in like positions of flexion and extension, and kind of that missing component is really working on like strengthening and being able to control rotation. Yeah. So that, and then I think like another thing to mention too, is kind of, there's a big connection between the hip and the pelvic floor. So I work really closely with with one of my colleagues who is a pelvic floor specialist PT, and we often see like a lot of overlap between the hip and pelvic floor. And so just being able to know like when to refer someone to get a pelvic floor consult. And like typically when I'm starting to think that, hey, I think maybe they should see a pelvic floor PT is when we've been working for several weeks on, you know, targeted strengthening, and they're either like their pain's not getting better, or they're just having a hard time kind of feeling like they're getting stronger, like feeling the muscles activating. And so I think in that scenario, like what could be going on is if you have pelvic floor weakness or hypertonicity, that can inhibit like those outer hip muscles from being able to contract and do their job. So I think that that's a big thing. You know, I think people should know if they have hip pain, like kind of advocate for that, even if you, you know, you don't think, oh, you know, you don't have pelvic pain, but that doesn't mean that the pelvic floor is not playing a role in your symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are some really great points. I want to circle back to you mentioning the deep rotators. This to me is fascinating in terms of like the evolution of how we approach FII in terms of like physical therapy. And it's not something I really paid attention to until a couple of years ago. Cause I think I was, you know, was focused on like, okay, well, you gotta, you know, stabilize the trunk, strengthen the glutes. And that is quite effective for a lot of people. But I found like the best results I've seen are when the physical therapist I work with really hammers like the deep rotators. And I guess the way I heard it described, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there was I think it was Mark Saffron out of Stanford. I attended a lecture and he was talking about hip labrum pathology. And one of the things he talked about is this phenomenon where like if you get this impingement in the anterior hip, it's almost like hitting like a speed bump when you just do certain maneuvers like flexing the hip or rotating the hip. And then that changes the trajectory of the movement pattern of the hip, such that those deep rotators, and which may include like piriformis, quadratus femoris, and several others, then tend to get almost like hyperactive. I don't know if that's the right word. And essentially trying to have muscles like the size of like two finger breadths, trying to do the work of like your glute max, which is like the size of your palm. And then oftentimes these patients present with really confounding pictures of like buttock pain, groin pain. And even in some patients, if they're so overactive in the deep rotators, it'll start to produce some almost like ischial femoral impingement type symptoms where you're essentially getting this transient compression of the sciatic nerve with particular movements that are not characteristic of, say, a lumbar type pattern where it's a flexion extension. It's more of like a hip rotational movement may produce that sciatic type symptom.
Yeah. And how I explain it to patients is kind of like, okay, you have the ball of the thigh bone, the femoral head, and then you have this socket, and you want that ball to be nice and centered in the joint. And what typically is happening with FAI and labral tears is, yeah, most often it's the anterior superior part of the hip and the labrum. You're getting increased loading, kind of stress on that area of the hip, and which is typically a result of there's an imbalance in the hip muscles doing their job. So kind of explain it as like, you know, you have your inner thigh muscles, the front hip muscles, the side hip muscles, the back hip muscles, and the deep hip muscles. And all of those muscles have to be doing their job together to kind of keep that ball, the femoral head, centered in that joint. And I think, you know, a typical kind of pain pattern I'll see is a lot of times people will have like a lot of pain in the adductors and, you know, kind of this feeling of like, oh, my hip feels so tight, and, you know, they want to stretch it. And then I think that that's actually one thing I would really want people to know is like, be very cautious with stretching, especially like flexion and adduction, because a lot of times, like, when there is that imbalance in the muscle strength and muscle coordination, you're developing what we call as more tone. So it's not that the muscle is actually truly tight, kind of like what you're explaining, but it's just really irritated and guarded. And then when you go to stretch it, I explain it kind of like a slinky effect where, you know, it feels good in the moment, but then it recoils and kind of becomes even more painful, like, because, you know, it doesn't actually need to be stretched. So the stretching is aggravating it. So yeah, I think that's why I think that's, it can be tough because there's so many muscles involved in the hip. And when they're doing an exercise routine, or like a clinician is developing an exercise routine, they have to make sure that they're targeting all of those muscles appropriately.
Yeah. I like that slinky analogy. That's a good one. So do you have a couple like go-to rehab exercises? And I know it's probably not maybe the right way to frame this, because I know it's more about like developing a strategy, but are there a couple key exercises that you do like for patients who have these issues?
Yeah. And I'll say like a concept I like early on to kind of develop together with the patient is kind of what we call like a rescue plan. So basically 3 to 4 things like the patient can do that they know it's not going to irritate their hip. Because I think when someone's going through this, and I know like from my experience with my own hip, can be frustrating and overwhelming, where you think like, I don't know what's going to irritate my hip or what's going to make it feel better. So something I like to do right away is kind of empower the person, like, hey, let's find these 3 to 4 things that are going to make your hip feel better. And so oftentimes what I see are, you know, hands and knees or quadruped rocking is really nice. It's a good self hip mobilization, kind of getting some movement through the hip joint. So I often give people that one right away. I find that it's also helpful to get patients who maybe have like a fear of moving into flexion. So it's kind of helpful for them to work into a position of flexion where it's a dynamic movement and they can control how deep they're going back into flexion. And I tell them, you know, in the beginning, kind of keeping things like pinch free and pain free. So not pushing through sharp pain. And then another kind of great series I'll start off with is a bridge series. So where having them do, you know, double leg bridges with a band above their knees. And there's a really good band called the Sirius Steel Band. It's like a thick cloth one that I really like because it's just tough. And I don't know, personally, I just use it and I feel like it's helpful. So doing that and then kind of pushing the knees apart and then moving into a bridge where you're activating the adductors, like squeezing a ball or Pilates ring. So those I find are typically ones where someone can do it and it won't aggravate the hip. And then I think another key concept is kind of starting off with double leg exercises. So, you know, keeping like that bridge double leg to start off with, because if you jump too soon to single leg exercise, that can flare up the hip. So just being aware of that.
Yeah, those are really great. Very accessible as well, it seems.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess now moving on to kind of other management things. Now, I don't necessarily want to frame this in the context of, you know, PT versus surgery, but because both are useful for like, depending on the situation, right?
Right.
But what should an athlete expect when they're choosing, you know, surgical and non-surgical treatment options in terms of like their projected outcome?
Right, right. And I think it's important too to highlight, yeah, I think we should kind of move away from this idea of like surgery versus PT, because really all of these patients, like regardless of what happens, like they need physical therapy or they need kind of targeted exercise. So kind of encouraging people, like, you know, either way, if you're going to have surgery, like you're still going to benefit from physical therapy, from targeted exercise. And so I think when someone's deciding, again, here's where like all those nuances come into play, because first we're looking at like, okay, where are they in their athletic journey? So, you know, if they're a high schooler, we want to be cautious because there's evidence to show that if they have a hip arthroscopy too early, like when the growth plate is still open, you can actually have like CAM morphology regrowth. So the bony bump can grow back, and this can lead to kind of the need for a second surgery or persistent pain. So I think being cautious when you're in high school is essential. And then moving on to like the collegiate athlete. So again, here's where time frames start to play a role. So if you have someone who is, say, like a junior, they only have 1.5 years left of sport, and they have, you know, pretty severe pain, and they've tried 2 to 3 months of physical therapy and not getting better, well, then that may be somebody who may pursue surgery, you know, faster than someone else, because they just simply don't have the time to wait, you know, 6 months or a year if their hip is going to get better. And then, like, I think the same thing is true for professional athletes and athletes like aspiring to be, say, in like the Olympics, right? They don't have the same kind of timeline as someone who is more of a recreational athlete, just doing it for fun.
Yeah, the timeline is quite a challenging one. I think I saw some studies by Joanne Kemp, which she looked at several studies and, you know, looked at the impact of a physical therapy program over 6 weeks and found, you know, kind of satisfactory to like okay results, right? Versus when it was a 3-month program, well, there was a much more significant impact on patient improvement.
Right. Yeah. And then in Australia, you know, like a lot of, her research has also shown kind of like the gold standard management for patients who are not getting surgery should be 6 months or even more, you know, of physical therapy. So I think that's something that in the US we have work to do to kind of change that perception of like, oh, I should only, you know, need 6 to 8 weeks and then my hip should be better. So I'm often telling patients, hey, like, look, you know, it's actually going to be like a 6 to even 9 month kind of journey until your hip is feeling a lot better. Now, obviously we want them to feel better, like have some sort of pain relief as soon as possible, but just looking at like long-term, it's going to take a while before you feel like you have complete control over your hip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was wondering if we can maybe touch on some of the long-term stuff and maybe for the purposes of this question, kind of focus on that patient who gets surgery for this. So, like a labrum repair, just to keep it simple, and the timeline for recovery. Because I've read some studies that show like there's like in the appropriate patient, right? You've done the whole workup, diagnostic injection, etc. Like if you look at, you know, patient satisfaction and reduction in pain, like 90% of patients are actually quite happy, especially in that first 6 months, right? Because like they had all this pain before and it's gone. But then when you ask like more specific questions about like were you able to return to your sport at your previous level, I think it was like a Danish study that talked about maybe only 50% achieve that. And then if you ask them like were you able to return at an optimal level of your sport, and maybe it was like 17%. And granted, this is one study out of the Danish population, but it does highlight a significant point that maybe I hope you can comment on of like what is that post surgical period look like, and how do you get people back to what they want to do at the level they want to do it at, or should you kind of reframe that mindset?
Right. So yeah, so expectations are huge. I mean, I think you know, there's a lot of research too that shows the biggest impact on outcome is patient expectations. So what they believe their recovery is going to look like. So I always, you know, err on the side of like stating, you know, it's going to be like a 6 to 12 month recovery, versus sometimes they'll hear from other clinicians like, oh, in 3 months you'll be back to running and you'll be better. So I think giving realistic expectations, and then you're right. You know, Mike Raymond has also done research in this realm of return to sport, but then, you know, return to performance, because they're very different things, right? And, you know, his research has showed that, you know, typically only one out of four people are actually getting back to returning to performance, like optimal performance after hip arthroscopy. So I think, you know, it's a tough discussion of where, like, you want to be optimistic and, like, you know, give the patient hope. You don't want to be like negative and say, oh, you're never going to get back, but you just want to help them be aware of, like, you know, hey, you can get back to your sport, but will you get back to performing? We don't know. You know, again, a lot of like nuances play a role in that. So I think just keeping that in mind, and, you know, there's also research that shows, like, yeah, in the short term, people after a hip arthroscopy feel better, but then at the 2-year mark, that there's no difference between those that had surgery and those that did not have surgery. So I think that's also important for people to know. And something I've kind of wondered, you know, is that, like, is it that when you have surgery, you know, you have to take that 3 to 5 months off where, like, you have to kind of completely shut down your routine and then slowly build it back up? So is that a reason that people maybe get better in the short term?
Yeah. So I'm really glad you highlighted that particular study where they looked at outcomes over 2 years and patients who opted for surgery and those that were treated conservatively. And just kind of shows that you don't really have to rush to anything. And I know because the conversation we always have is like, well, why do we worry about these things? Well, it's the, you know, obviously the pain, but also then the risk of arthritis is the big thing that looms in people's minds, right? And we know that there is an association, but we don't know, is that going to be 5 years? Is that going to be 20 years from the time of when you're symptomatic to the time you develop arthritis? So hearing that quote from that study is really encouraging for patients. And I know I had this conversation with an athlete the other day, because this is someone who's like in their like kind of late 20s, early 30s, who still has like the benefit of time with her athletic career that, you know, things are manageable. If in 2 years it's going to be kind of the same anyway, well, we need to kind of manage things for that. And if things obviously are going south, then, you know, we do have a good alternative as well. So.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think it's also important to highlight, like, we still don't know. There's still so much we don't know about, you know, FAI and labral tears and how it progresses to arthritis. And I think it's also important to know that, like, there's no long-term evidence to, like, really prove that having a hip arthroscopy prevents the development of hip osteoarthritis. And then here we can kind of mention, like, okay, so it's also helpful to know, like, some people are actually at a risk of the surgery itself causing this cascade of arthritis sooner. So, like, people who are above the age of 35, people who already have cartilage defects or signs of early arthritis on imaging are more likely to actually then kind of have arthritis happen sooner from the surgery. So I think just all things people should know, because I do think a lot of times people are told, like, oh, if you get this surgery, it's going to prevent arthritis. But the reality is, like, we still don't know if that's actually the case, right? And kind of, I think now the only thing we know significantly contributes to the development of osteoarthritis is, like, genetics, you know? So I think kind of keeping that in mind. But I do think, and even, like, for me personally, I was told that if I did not have a hip surgery, like, oh, you're going to get arthritis sooner, you're going to have to stop running. And I really don't like that that's kind of a fear tactic used. And so I, having gone through that and, like, you know, it significantly impacted, like, the mental journey of my hip pain, I just really hope clinicians don't keep saying that to people and kind of, yeah. And I hope that patients know or people know, like, even if you're told that it's not actually, like, evidence based yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like kind of the evolution of how you saw degenerative meniscus surgeries play out, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll tell that to patients too. I'll say, you know, a lot of like, there's a lot of similarities between labral tears and meniscus tears. And if you look at the trajectory of research and long-term outcomes of meniscus repair surgeries, I mean, it's not like meniscus repairs are no longer recommended for people with, you know, degenerative tears because the outcomes just weren't there to show that they were any better. And in fact, a lot of people are worse or again, have worsening knee OA.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, so it'll be interesting to see what this, where the research plays out in the next few years. But yeah, so this was a really great conversation, really informative. You've shared a lot of great information. I think that's going to be helpful for a lot of our listeners because it's just such a complex injury, and it's not as simple as, you know, PT versus surgery. You have a tear, you have to fix it. There's a lot of nuances, and just know that there's like a lot of really good options if you kind of carefully approach this. But with that being said, are there any like closing remarks or pieces of advice that you want to share either from your personal journey or as a clinician or kind of the whole gamut?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I often kind of reflect on like, you know, so it's been close to, 10 years since like I first had this hip pain when I was training for a marathon, and this whole journey of like seeing a surgeon and getting actually super depressed from hearing that I needed this surgery. I had to stop running. My hip was going to get worse. Long story short, I was able to get back to marathon running triathlons without having surgery. And I think some key things I would tell like my younger self or like someone in that scenario is like, you're right, you have options. So, you know, get a second opinion, get a third opinion, and find healthcare providers who like you trust and who, I also think it's really important that, like, let's say if you're a runner, then your healthcare provider should also be a runner or should be really well versed in running. Same thing goes for like, if you're a dancer, like find a healthcare provider who specializes in treating dancers, right? Because I think that, you know, unfortunately not every healthcare provider is well-versed in how to manage people with hip pain related to FAI and labral tears. And that there are experts out there, right? And so just keep looking and keep finding like that healthcare provider who specializes in your sport and who's on your team and like kind of believes in you that you can get back to, you know, whatever sport it is. I think that's kind of the getting into again those nuances where like you can't treat a hockey player with FAI and labral tear the same as you're going to treat a marathon runner. You know, there's, yeah, they could have the same diagnosis, but there's a lot of things that go into the management of both of those people. And so you really need a healthcare provider who kind of specializes in that sport.
Well, thank you so much. What we'll do is we'll attach a couple of some of the resources we've quoted here. Some of these common studies that if you're a clinician, it'd be great to kind of share with your patients, or if you're someone who just wants more information about your condition, we can attach that in the show notes as well. But thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, and hope you have a great weekend.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.